Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We're just a few weeks into the new school year, but data about last year continues to be released. One area of concern for years has been test scores. They fell precipitously during and after the pandemic, and educators locally and nationwide have been working to get them back up. At CMS, improving literacy is on the front burner. Administrators set goals, and according to recently released results, they have been having success. Last year, 72% of students hit their benchmarks. It was an increase over previous years, but it didn't quite reach the goals they set, and there are more ambitious goals ahead for this year. All these goals have lots of numbers associated with them, and we don't want to get bogged down in the numbers, but we do want to examine these objectives and what's being done to achieve them. And because reading at grade level is a challenge almost everywhere in the country, we'll look at why that is so, and at various methods used over the years to teach children how to read and then comprehend what they have read. We're joined by WFAE's education reporter, James Farrell. He's here along with Monroe Richardson, executive director of Read Charlotte. That's a community-driven initiative that brings together educators, families, and others to improve reading in the early grades. And Dr. Devin Kearns is the Goodnight Distinguished Professor in Early Literacy at NC State University. Everybody, thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. James, I'm going to begin with you, and we're going to begin off topic. We'll come back to all of this that we just set up in a moment, but something happened yesterday that we do need to address, and that is the announcement yesterday by Queen's University of Charlotte that they will merge in 2026 with Elon University. What does that mean?
Yeah, we don't know a lot of the specifics yet. What we've been told is that they have come to an agreement that they intend to merge, but over the next few months, they're going to be hashing out what the actual formal structure is going to look like, and they'll plan to finalize that by around November. What school leaders have said at this point is that students at Queen's University, at least, and students at both universities shouldn't expect kind of a disruption to their day-to-day activities, day-to-day education. They're hoping this leads to new academic opportunities and graduate programs and real-world experience. But what this actually specifically looks like yet, that's all still being hashed out, and we just don't know that much yet.
Now, this will take place, as we said, before the start of the next school year, and by the end of 2026, they should be one combined unit. And the quote that I read was that, quote, Elon will operate Queen's in partnership with existing and legacy leaders. Is this a merger of equals, or is Elon taking over Queen's?
So they definitely are presenting it as a merger of equals. That quote there kind of says that Elon is taking over, but at the same time, they're working with the leaders. So it kind of seems like both of those things are happening at once. I know Elon University officials at the press conference yesterday were careful to say that they wanted to maintain the legacy of Queen's University and whatever branding they create next. But again, I mean, until we start seeing this kind of get hashed out more, we're not going to have a lot of those specifics yet in terms of what this actually looks like. I know that leaders are planning a listening tour to kind of hear from the community and start sharing ideas of this vision starting in October in the lead up to them finalizing all of this.
Jessie Curithan is the interim president at Queen's University of Charlotte. She says that the merger will bring additional academic opportunities, graduate programs, and real-world experience, and that Queen's would benefit from Elon's, quote, reputation and broader alumni network. That explains what this does for Queen's. What does this do for Elon?
Yeah, well, we've seen Elon in the last couple of years expand its footprint in Charlotte a little bit. They started a flex law program here, a health program. So it does give Elon an opportunity to kind of make inroads in the city here. It's obviously a really quickly developing region with a lot of students coming in the pipeline, a lot of people moving to the area. So, you know, I think that it just gives Elon an opportunity to kind of get a foothold here in a really quickly growing region where they are hoping to develop a talent pipeline and kind of be engaged here.
This announcement seemed to come out of the blue. It took me completely by surprise. It's not you have the education beat in at WFAE. I'm wondering if it took you by surprise.
Yeah, we hadn't heard too much about it in the days leading up to it or talk about this too much. There had been a press advisory that went out just that they had an announcement to make. But beyond that, I had not really had any indication that something like this was happening.
But something like this does not happen overnight. This takes months of negotiation and discussion, and somebody has to bring up the idea first. How did this come to be? How long has this been in the works? Do we know?
Well, we know that Queen's University has had a leadership change in recent months, and it seems that maybe some of the conversations around this might have started with that and kind of those discussions, but precisely how much we don't know exactly.
In a press release, Jesse Curtin, the head of Queen's, writes, quote, "Over the last several months, we have faced challenges with resilience and determination, and the Board of Trustees has been steadfast in guiding us toward a sustainable and inspiring path forward." You report that financial filings for the school show that Queens had more than $88 million in revenue in 2023, the most recent year available, but they had $109 million worth of expenses. They still have a serious endowment at play here, and they have more assets than they have expenses. But could that have played a role in this, that they're up against an operating budget crunch?
Yeah, so to be clear, Queen's University leaders were very deliberate in this announcement yesterday. And if you go on the new merger website that they've created, there's an FAQ there that spells this out, that this was not meant to be in response to some sort of crisis or to some sort of financial situation. But certainly when you're looking at the filings and you're looking at the finances here, this is a situation where Elon is in a little bit of a better financial situation in terms of, you know, its revenue was $413 million in 2024, which is the most recent year available, and its expenses were $398 million. So it's in the black. As opposed to Queens. So it is a situation where Elon is merging with Queens and Elon is in a little bit of a better financial situation. So I'm sure it probably played some kind of a role, but at least publicly up to this point, that has not been cited as the main reason why this is happening.
Would this have happened had there not been a change of leadership at the top?
Yeah, that's difficult to say. I read some reporting that had said that it was that change of leadership that started some of the conversation. So I do think that kind of inspired it and kind of inspired some of the conversations.
Because Queens has been working very hard in recent years to raise their profile and also to raise their profile athletically. They recently became a Division I set of teams. What does this merger mean for that?
Yeah, that definitely stood out to me because the Division I news had happened somewhat recently. So it's interesting that this merger is happening kind of not long after they officially became a Division I school. But, you know, Queen's University leaders and messages to students and alumni have been saying that remaining a Division I status is a priority still. I had read some reporting that said that they had committed to athletics being held on both campuses. But what that looks like, what that means for the Royals branding, that's all going to be hashed out as this continues to be worked out over the next few months.
And you may not be able to answer this question because literally this came out yesterday afternoon, I believe, this announcement. So there's been very little time to digest it, but what has been, if there has been any reaction by Queen's faculty, staff, and students?
Yeah, I haven't gotten that far in the reporting yet on this. Okay. So that's something we'll definitely be looking at in the weeks to come.
Okay, so let's move on to what we planned to talk about this morning, and that is test scores and reading and how we teach reading and how it's changed over the years and why this continues to be a struggle for young people learning to read. Recap briefly, James, the history of the test scores that we have talked about in recent years, particularly at CMS, that have shown, particularly post-pandemic, some pretty miserable results, although they are going up. Talk about that. How long have students in our public schools struggled to read, if you go by the numbers?
Well, if you go by national test scores that we've seen, which includes CMS, the nation's report card, which is the test that's administered to a representative sample of students across the country, there's an argument to be made that this is a trend that actually predates the pandemic, that reading has always had some challenges. We definitely saw a dip in scores locally here at CMS. We've started to see some recovery from that in the last few years. The question is whether or not that's happening at a fast enough pace to get students caught up, and more importantly, for the district to be able to achieve the goals that the board has set and the benchmark numbers that it has set to try to deem successful.
Dr. Kearns is with us. Dr. Kearns is Devin Kearns is the distinguished professor of early literacy at NC State University. clearly you've had your eyes on this problem for a very long time. What is the main problem here?
I wouldn't boil it down to just one thing. Reading is very hard to teach. Literacy is very hard to learn. English presents some particularly unique challenges in that regard we can talk about. And so it's a pattern that's resulted from some of that. It's also a result of some instructional mistakes we made for a long time historically about the best ways to teach reading, and sort of correcting that has been an important effort over the past few years with what you probably heard of, the science of reading movement. Yeah. And so that's sort of where this kind of came from. And the pandemic, of course, had a terrible impact on all these things too. So we're still seeing the need to recover from that.
And we're going to talk about all of that in the course of this hour, because it's pretty Byzantine and it kind of all intersects with each other. But the CMS system, James, sets goals, and they've usually found themselves unable to meet those goals, but they set these goals. And a few weeks ago, the system announced that K-2 students' early literacy test scores had risen to 72%, which means what?
Yeah, so specifically what we're talking about with those test scores is scores on the DIBELS test, the Dynamic Indicators of Basic Early Literacy Skills. I hope I have that right. and it is a test that measures sort of the building block skills of literacy for younger students. It's administered 3 times a year. It's administered across the country, so you have kind of national data that you can compare it with. We've seen some big boosts in those scores in recent years across the state, which state leaders have attributed to investment in the science of reading, which we're going to talk about more about, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So what they're talking about there is the number of students who by the end of the year are reaching their benchmark levels that they're shooting for. So that 72% means 72% of those K-2 students have reached that benchmark. Now, to be clear, sorry, Mike, go ahead.
That's all right. No, go ahead. To be clear.
Yeah, to be clear, the goal is to reach, the exact number is, I believe it, hold on 1 second, I have it here somewhere. To reach 91% by June of 2029. Right. So they have sort of these annual targets that they're trying to hit to stay on pace to reach that goal. So the 72% increase is great. It is, as school leaders will tell you, a little shy of the target for this year, which then puts them in a hole that they have to make up for next year.
This is exactly what we talk about when we do our fund drives here at WFAE. We have goals that we have to hit, and if we don't hit them, then we're in trouble. And the system had this goal of going from 67% of proficiency in 2023 to 91% by 2029. They hit 72%, but that's 3% below what they had planned to be at this point, which was 75%. So what does that say about the reality of being able to meet these goals by 2029? Can you catch up?
Yeah, I think it says that, kind of as Devin was just talking about, I mean, reading is very difficult to teach. And the CMS officials will be the first to tell you that these goals were very ambitious. Superintendent Crystal Hill often describes them as Herculean. So it's definitely not something that's an easy thing to do. It's not going to happen overnight. We're also seeing shifts in how we teach reading. So it could be maybe next year we see a bigger bump, or maybe we see a decline if something's not working. So it is kind of a trial and error almost to try to figure out how to get there. But I think for CMS's sake, just seeing the increase is definitely a positive sign.
And that's one of the things we're going to spend some time this hour talking about, the fact that we do keep changing the way we teach reading, which is a little puzzling to the layperson, I think, because they learn to read, and we've been learning to we've been teaching people how to read since writing was invented. That's thousands of years. Why haven't we figured this out? We're going to talk about all of that and much more when we come back. James Farrell is with us. He's WFAE's education reporter. Dr. Devin Kearns, professor of early literacy at NC State. And we will hear from Monroe Richardson with Charlotte Reads when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about reading and how we teach it in the public schools and why reading has fallen behind. Reading comprehension and the ability to learn to read, evidently very difficult, and we're having trouble reaching goals that have been set with by CMS and other systems around the country. And Dr. Kearns, I don't want to get bogged down in the numbers, but let's just spend a few seconds here on the numbers that we know. Last year, 72% of students at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools in grades K through 2 could read at grade level. That's almost three quarters of the students. Meanwhile, only 33% of students in grades 3 through 8 were at grade level, and that was below what I think is a miserable goal of 37%. These figures sound unacceptable, even dire, are they?
Yes. I think we have a lot of tremendous work to do to improve literacy outcomes across the country. One challenge with some of these statistics is the reason we see this discrepancy between the early literacy skills and those more advanced literacy skills is the kind of way we do testing. The way we evaluate student response in K2, K3 is different than the way we measure it in later grades. And that's part of the reason you see this mismatch between what James described as kind of the DIBLE skills and some of the higher order skills you see later. So yeah, that's a big piece of it. And then the benchmark for proficiency is quite high. And so that's part of the explanation also for the reason we have this kind of apparent bifurcation.
James.
Yeah, and then just one point of clarity too, back to the idea that these goals are, you know, are ambitious. That 33% number is not describing grade level proficiency. It's describing students who are scoring at the 4 or 5 level on the EOGs. That's career and college ready. So if you get at least a 3, that's grade level proficient. 4 or 5 is career and college ready. So the goals that CMS has set are actually targeting for the next level of achievement. So that means they're trying to get both students who are not grade level proficient up to that 4 or 5 level, as well as students who are grade level proficient up to that next level, that 4 and 5
level. This is exactly why I don't want to get bogged down in these numbers, because my head is going to explode. I know that, Monroe, you want to chime in on this, and I want to let you say whatever you wanted to say. But given what Dr. Kern said just a second ago, that later school years may perform differently than the earlier school years, we have these younger students performing at 72% of grade level, while the older students are at 33%. Does that mean that the younger students, when they get to fifth grade, are likely to perform worse than they did, at least by these scores, than they did recently in the second grade?
Well, I admit that this all can be confusing. There are a lot of numbers and a lot of acronyms. And so let me just, for the listeners, put this in plain language. Okay. So, you know, the goal of reading is reading comprehension, right? It's to be able to understand what you're reading. And there really are three basic levels. There is reading on the line, reading between the lines, and reading beyond the lines. And that reading on the lines is very basic literal comprehension. Between the lines is when you're making inferences, that you are connecting what you already know, your prior knowledge, to make meaning of what you're reading. And then reading beyond the lines is like critically evaluating what you read. And that notion of college and career ready that James mentioned is really, we want kids to be able to read in between the lines and beyond the lines. That's really what that college and career ready level means. And so your question, Mike, about fifth graders, that's what we want them to be able to do, to be successful in school and beyond. But there are four major sort of inputs to reading comprehension, right? And so we've talked about one of those. That's the DIBLE scores. That's really measuring kids' word reading skills. So when you hear that 91% goal, what CMS is saying is that we want 91% of our K-2 students to have strong grade level word reading skills by 2029, right? But there are three other really important inputs as well. First, they need a strong foundation before they even start school. And those are things that early childhood experts call executive skills. The ability to manage your thoughts, your emotions, your actions, those are all critically important for the other skills you develop. But alongside those word reading skills are also language and listening comprehension skills, things like your vocabulary, your grammar, syntax, your ability to inference and reason. And you begin to develop comprehension skills way early before you can even read a word on a page. And so those come together with one other critical factor, and that's background knowledge. Do you understand things about the world around you? And you bring all those skills together to be able to comprehend. And so if you imagine all of these pieces working together, gaps or deficiencies in any of those areas all contribute to what children are able to do by the time they end up in third grade taking that EOG.
And is that why pre-K has been recognized as being so fundamentally important, and why parents reading to children, talking to children before they get to kindergarten has become so recognized as being so important? What you
Absolutely.
Just said.
Absolutely. The investments that our county has made in expanding access to pre-K for four-year-olds, the MEC pre-K program, CMS's own programs that it administer. But I would say you put those programs together, that we have sort of three parts of our public pre-K system. We're still roughly talking about 50% of the kids that are coming into kindergarten every year in CMS. So that's really important. And then I couldn't stress more the importance of parents reading regularly with their kids. If your listeners are, you know, driving around Charlotte, you'll see billboards from our organization encouraging families to read together. That is one of the most powerful things that families can do to build those early language and comprehension skills.
Dr. Kearns, reading and math scores are what we concentrate on, although there are other subject matter that we probably ought to concentrate on a little more, like civics and history, given our current state of affairs in this country. But we saw performance in reading and math after the pandemic collapse, essentially, and getting them back up to stasis has been really difficult, not just at CMS, but in school systems around the country. And we don't see our students, American students, don't seem to be doing as well as their counterparts in other Western countries. Is that the case? And if so, do we understand why?
I think there is some evidence that we're not doing as well as our peers across the country. I forget where exactly the numbers are, but we definitely have a big challenge compared to some other countries. One reason that it's challenging in English is that English itself is kind of a challenging language to learn to read. So one fact about English is that when you think about the way letters and sounds are connected, they're not as connected as well as they are in some other languages. They did an interesting study some years ago where they examined how long it would take a student to learn all of the things they need to know to read all the words in the language, essentially. And in most languages like Greek and Turkish, it takes about a year through the end of first grade. In English, they found that it takes until fourth grade to be able to read all of the words in the language, in part because the language is so complex. And they estimated that by the end of first grade, a student learning English, they did this in Scotland and England, knew only 30% of the words in the language, whereas in Greek and Turkish, it was like 93%. So the language itself presents kind of a challenge. And then we also just have a need to improve the way we're teaching reading. And I think that's a big piece of it also.
All you have to do is think about the words enough, cough, cuff, all spelled incorrectly, but they sound like Fs, there, and there, which is a big problem for a lot of kids. Monroe, you're the executive director of Read Charlotte, which was launched 10 years ago to address the problem of low performance in reading in our schools here. What was the impetus? How did that organization begin? Was it somebody outside of CMS that said we need to do this? Was it somebody within CMS who suggested we do this? How did it happen?
Well, there were a number of local leaders that came together looking at this issue about a year after the Read to Achieve legislation was passed. And the real leader within that group was the Belk Foundation, that was looking at their own philanthropy, narrowed in to K-3 and identified early literacy as a critical issue. But if you look at who was around the table, you had folks from the county, the school district, business community, philanthropy, all coming together recognizing that early literacy was a critical issue. The other thing to remember, this was also around the same time that the Raj Chetty report came out and identified Charlotte as 50 out of 50. So a lot of concerns about economic mobility, economic opportunity. And it's pretty clear that unless kids are able to read, unless they're able to do math, they're not gonna have the chances they need to be able to move up in life.
So your organization, Read Charlotte, has been working for about 10 years to support CMS in its efforts to meet its literacy goals, but you don't run programs. So how do you do what you do?
That's right. Well, part of the idea with Read Charlotte was we had plenty of programs. We didn't need one other program. But the belief was that we needed an organization that could pull everyone together, get everyone working together, move them in the same direction. And a lot of what we do is read research by folks like Dr. Kearns and others, and we help translate that into plain language. We help, in some cases, create tools and resources. We provide advice for nonprofits and funders. We partner with the district deeply over the years. So sometimes we're a convener. We bring people together around targeted issues. Sometimes we're a catalyst. We get things started. Sometimes we're an advocate. We're pushing for improvements or changes. And other times we're an advisor. And so it puts us in sort of a unique role, but it really helps pull everyone together in a way that helps us all sort of lean and push in the same direction to solve this important issue that our community deeply cares about.
So Dr. Kearns, I've been doing the show a long time, and we've talked a lot over the years about struggling with learning to read and reading proficiency scores being low. And I'm just wondering how far back this goes. Has this always been a problem for young people? Even when people read voraciously, because there was no radio, there was no television, there were no movies, there was no social media. Has it always been a problem?
Yeah, in some ways it's been a problem. I think the problem is exacerbated by mistakes that were made in terms of misunderstanding the science behind reading. And so in the 60s and 70s, there's this movement you probably have heard of to do something called whole language, which was a way of teaching kids to read that de-emphasized word recognition skill that Monroe talked about. And the result was that because we didn't teach kids word recognition, they simply weren't able to access print. So if you want to comprehend, you have to get the words, I always say, like, from the page through your eyes. You can't do any of that other stuff unless you can actually read the words. And whole language put us in a space where kids weren't getting an adequate amount of emphasis on the beginning skills.
To put that in language that I, as a child of the 50s and 60s, understand, whole language ignored phonics. Is that correct?
Yep, that's largely correct, yes.
So without phonics, you don't know how to sound out what you're seeing on the page, and therefore you can't read it. That seems to be self-evident. How did educators who are immersed in pedagogy, how did they reach the conclusion that whole language is the way to go here after years of teaching it the other way with some success?
Yeah, so I mean, there were lots of ways even before that in which people did not actually use that approach. So you remember like Dick and Jane books, or you've heard of those,
yes,
right? That was a different way of teaching it called a look-say approach, which didn't involve phonics really either. But the whole language approach really came from the idea that if we understand language, spoken language, as Monroe was saying, that we can actually figure out the words just by referencing our knowledge of the language, like, oh, we can conclude, oh, so, you know, I saw a blank under the chair. Well, if it's a word, then it's got to be mouse, right? And so people started to think if we use context, that can actually be the key to this. And so it was sort of, and it was pushed by some advocates for this approach. So it wasn't, I think, the fault of teachers. I think they were listening to important people.
So I use the C-Spot Run books, so the Dick and Jane books, as a child, and I remember seeing C-Spot Run after the ball, or that's probably more advanced than those books actually were. But it was later that we were introduced to phonics, and I always had trouble reading. Learning to read was a challenge for me. And I got put into a special unit called SRL or SRM or whatever, something where you read from flashcards and you advanced at your own rate. So clearly, what should come first, phonics or see the word and say, see, spot, run? If you don't know that R sounds like R, how can you read that?
You need to learn that from the very beginning. So we really don't emphasize using that look-say approach, the Dick and Jane approach at all. We really emphasize teaching students the connection between the letter and the sound and using that information to figure out the words. And so even in a word like through, you know, or whatever, there's still some part of it that works. The TH and the R, like, they do say what you'd expect. And that's part of what we do is teach students, these are things you can use, even though we must acknowledge things get a little bit wacky in English for the reasons that you said.
So Monroe, what do we do now? Which approach is CMS and most of the public schools taking?
Well, I think thanks to especially to a lot of good reporting by Emily Hanford over the last 6, 7 years, you've seen a lot of emphasis across the country in what's known as the science of reading, and a lot of focus on systematic, explicit instruction of word reading skills, like Professor Curran said. But at the same time, I would say reading science is no different than medical science or any other sciences, and that we're constantly learning new things. And compared in 2025 compared to 2020, we actually know a lot more about reading comprehension than we did back then, a lot more research. And so one area that I think in particular that we have a big opportunity in our district and frankly across the state is to really lean in on building children's language and listening comprehension skills. Earlier, that just systematically has not been something that we've focused on. We've just sort of assumed that kids would develop these, and then they show up at school with what they need. And if you look at our state assessments, you look at our interim assessments, DIBELS does not look at all at language and listening comprehension. And Dr. Hill, Crystal Hill, the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, has lifted this up as an area of interest and priority for the district moving forward as well.
But I keep coming back to this. People have been reading since Gutenberg. People have been learning to read and successfully reading and getting along in the world because they can read since Gutenberg. And you say we keep learning things about how to teach this, but reading is thousands of years old. And we keep changing the way we teach it. Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? We discovered that whole language is not the way to do it. We're going back to phonics, which was something that they did in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Why the continuous change? Why not stick with something that works?
Well, again, I think reading science is very akin to other kinds of medical science. Like we're learning, you would think we inhabit our bodies, we should know everything about it. Well, we're constantly learning more about that. And for a long time, there were parts of reading that literally were a black box. And part of the challenges of some of the past practices, like whole language, we looked at kids who were successful and we said, oh, this seems to work for them, we should do it for everyone. And that was a misinterpretation of what was going on because we really didn't understand well enough what was happening inside the black box. And we do know more today. I will say, Mike, what's sort of interesting, several years ago, I actually found an old digest from Mecklenburg County. We had challenges in literacy back in the early 1900s.
Monroe Richardson's executive director of Read Charlotte. We're going to continue our conversation about reading and how why it's so difficult when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, home ownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about reading skills and reading scores and why they're climbing so slowly after the pandemic, during which there was a great dip off among elementary and even high school students. We're talking about this with Monroe Richardson, executive director of Read Charlotte, Dr. David Kearns, the Goodnight Distinguished Professor of Early Literacy at NC State University, and WFAE's education reporter, James Farrell. And James, CMS, I want to go back to something that you talked about a little while ago. CMS set these reading goals, which were moving in the right direction, but at a slower pace than they'd like. And you report that at the last school board meeting, Superintendent Crystal Hill noted that these are Herculean or Herculean, I'm not sure how you say that, goals. Is she saying that they set the expectations too high?
I don't know that she's saying that they set them too high, but she's definitely saying that they set them high. One of the points she made there that I thought was interesting was that, we saw a 3% increase in that, college and career ready level this year, and that in a typical year, we might be celebrating that. But when you put it in the context of this goal, it maybe looks like it's not as successful as it is. So I think maybe it's more about setting the context there and setting the idea that the expectation is really high going into this.
So, Dr. Kearns, as we've talked about, we've been changing the way we approach teaching people to read over time. So have we lost our way in terms of that, or are we finding our way in terms of that?
Yeah, I think we're finding our way. I think one important fact about the science of reading, or sometimes people call it SOR, is, which I really don't like the term SOR, because I think it turns science into a hashtag. And what I do think is true is that it's not a hashtag. We have learned a lot over the past several decades about the science of reading, actually the science. And I think that people like me and other folks, and I see Monroe nodding as well, which you can't see on the radio, but it's true, is that we have started to embrace that. And I think what makes a difference is that folks like myself, we're sort of, I think, honest brokers here, because the science takes you in directions you didn't expect. And as long as you're willing to say, we didn't get it right before, then we can move forward, right? If we don't kind of stand on ceremony and sort of focus on the things we just think are true, if we're willing to follow the science, and that's kind of the way I approach things, then I think we're going to move forward. And that's, I think, what's happening is a lot of people are embracing the science, whatever it says.
So, I know you don't like the term science of reading. I'm not sure what you would call it. Maybe you have a better term for it, but can you explain it? What is the science of it?
Yeah, so I mean, Monroe started to speak to this. I mean, the idea is there's something called the simple view of reading. And this is a very simple idea. And the idea is that, I think I might have said this before, reading involves two things. One is getting the words from the page through your eyes. And that's the what we call word recognition, right? Which is a critical. You cannot do anything else without being able to recognize the words. And then the second piece of it is language comprehension, which is spinning all those words around in your brain and figuring out what they actually mean. And so those are the pieces of the puzzle, and we have to have both of those things in place in order to be successful in reading.
And Monroe, North Carolina has spent, to its credit, millions of dollars in training teachers how to understand how children come to learn to read, or how they understand the science of reading. And it seems to be helping very, very slowly. But as somebody who goes into the schools and works with the schools and works with students, what seems to be the biggest stumbling block for these young people? Do you understand it?
Yeah, I first of all, I do think that North Carolina is to be commended for its effort and this investment. We might take it for granted that we have statewide assessment systems, statewide training of teachers. That's not necessarily the case in every state, so that's really important. Likewise, I think CMS is to be commended to have public goals like this and to have them as visible. Like I've heard at the state national level, like districts don't do that. So that's one thing I think is important. Compared to 10 years ago, we now have one high quality curriculum everywhere. We have consistent training, consistent support. You've got really strong focus on continuous improvement. You have groups like the Charlotte Executive Leadership Council, with the put executives in residence and adding business processes, advice to what the district already does well. So I think we've got, along with the strong leadership in place, we're really in the, I would say, the best place that I've seen in the last 10 years to be able to really lean in and make improvements. The challenge, Mike, is that schools never have and never can do it all by themselves. So what happens outside of the classroom? So we need families reading with their kids. That's why we have the Read Together campaign. We need out of school, after school programs, provide extra supports for kids. We should not forget that kids in higher socioeconomic households get extra support all the time. They're getting extra tutoring, extracurricular programs. So it's never just the schools, it's a community, it's a village. And part of the challenge is how do we provide those extra supports for kids whose families don't have as much money to pay for that? Families in the highest high income bracket on average spend $2,100 a year on extracurriculars. Families in the low bracket, 700, right? So that just that's very, very different. And then when you're in a school that has high levels of poverty versus ones with low levels of poverty, these just aren't the same conditions. That's why we need the community to lead in. We need businesses and churches and other groups to partner and adopt schools. We need to invest in tutoring and after school programs. We need to invest in summer programs, and we need to make sure that kids are starting school on the strong foot by investing in early childhood programs. All of these give kids the advantage to be successful with what CMS brings.
James.
Yeah, just to add a little more context to Monroe's point, and we've seen the nation's report card scores have come out, you know, for the 12th grade reading more recently, and then earlier in our last school year, we saw it for 4th and 8th grade reading. And one of the common themes that we heard from officials at the federal level was this concern about a rising gap between high and low performing students and the way that that kind of drive some of these declines that we've seen there. Just sort of the idea that students who are struggling are having a harder time kind of being lifted up to continue to keep pace with those who are doing well and are already high performing, and it kind of exacerbates that. And we've seen that in some of the reporting on CMS's goals too. Some of the information they've provided in the agenda have suggested that those gaps are widening here between high and low performing students as well, and then that exacerbates the challenges.
Superintendent, CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill has said that sometimes, especially in the earlier grades, there is an overemphasis on decoding, her word, which is figuring out the words by the sounds the letters make. And that can come at the expense of spending time with comprehension, which we've talked a little bit about, understanding what it all means when you put it in the sentence and you put the sentence in the middle of a paragraph. What's being said here? And Dr. Kearns, you've said that effective literacy instruction should focus, quote, on foundational skills, including phonological awareness, word recognition, and comprehension, without spending too much time on any one element. Is there a roadmap on how you bring all this together so that you don't spend too much time on what she calls decoding or too much time on comprehension when you can't read the word itself? How do you bring it all together?
I don't think there's like an exact prescription, because I think it depends a lot on the students in front of you. You know, James spoke to the fact that we're seeing this widening gap between the highest and lowest performing students. And research has shown that the way in which you make the max amount of progress is by providing the students the right balance between word recognition and language comprehension instruction based on the skills they currently have. So if you have students who are low performing, you don't give them enough decoding in lessons led by the teacher, you're not going to make enough progress. The opposite is true for kids who are already higher performing. If you give them too much emphasis on early decoding skills, they'll also not make adequate progress. And that's one concern in even like a lot of low-income districts. You have these students who are already successful. Sometimes, because there's so many kids who have reading difficulty, they put in these groups that are too low level for them. And the result is they're not actually getting enough of the language comprehension that they really need.
Monroe, I'm seeing you nod vigorously at everything he's saying. So let me get your take on this.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, there is a ceiling, like a limit on how much of that phonics or decoding instruction kids can take. But you can never give them enough or too much knowledge about the world, opportunities to build their comprehension skills, even with you know, really good interactive read alouds, experiences around the world. That's why, in addition to the formal instruction to get in a classroom and tutoring and those skills for kids who need it, but opportunities to go to the museums, the science centers, you know, understanding, learning about the world, because they're going to bring that knowledge about the world into the tasks they have around reading comprehension. One of the passages of the EOG example is a reading comprehension passage about beavers. Well, if you don't know anything about beavers or anything about rivers or dams, it's going to be very hard for you to comprehend that, even if you can sound out all the words.
James.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when we look at this kind of new focus on reading comprehension. We've seen state leaders talk about that too with the release of the accountability data that came out earlier this month. You can see that reflected in the data, just to add a little context there, because we saw increases in most grades in reading except for third grade. And I just think that's interesting because that's the year that you start taking the EOGs, which have more of this focus on comprehension. So I think that kind of shows that challenge of going from learning the decoding stuff and then going into third grade and now having to deal with the comprehension stuff. I think that speaks to the importance of getting that comprehension in earlier so that you can be prepared for that shift to the third grade when you start taking these more complicated exams.
I don't know how familiar you are with this, James, because you're relatively new in this city, but CMS has traditionally had a pretty good national reputation, even though it gets some digs at the local level. by people, even though they may like their child's teacher or their child's school, they think of CMS as something not so good. And in fact, nationally, it's recognized as being a great achiever. But at the same time that CMS released their recent scores that we've been talking about, so did Union County. And Union County had the highest test scores in the state, with nearly 71% of students scoring at grade level. A statewide rate was 55%. So they're superseding the state level by a substantial margin. And they attribute that to the letters program, the LETRS program, which we really haven't talked about by calling it letters. But that's something that I believe the former superintendent of state instruction, Catherine Truitt, really pushed. Does anybody understand the factors at work here that put Union County so far ahead of CMS and so far ahead of the state?
Yeah, so in speaking to Union County officials, I mean, they cited, like you mentioned, the letters training as being helpful. I also spoke to some educators who spoke about kind of focusing on inferencing and diving into some of that comprehension stuff. But, you know, I think you also have to acknowledge some of the differences between Union County and a district like CMS, which is so much larger and covers such a broader area and many diverse populations. CMS has a lot more English learners, and that's obviously presenting challenges. We talked about earlier how difficult it is to teach reading. That was assuming that we're teaching it to people who already know how to speak the language or who are growing up in households that do speak the language. If you're also right. learning from a different language, that creates a whole other layer of challenges. So I do think there's also sort of that reality at play that CMS is trying to do this at such a broader scale and across so many different kind of different subgroups and challenges and barriers and things like that.
And Monroe, because English is a amalgamation of so many different languages over time, although we are a rules-based language, we don't stick to the rules. And that makes things very difficult for people who come from a different language background. Is that part of the problem at CMS? We have so many ESL students who are learning English as a second language and trying to grapple with the weird rules that we have.
Absolutely. I mean, you heard Professor Kearns talk about that before. You know, some languages, it's very direct or transparent, the relationship between how letters are combined and the sounds they represent in spoken language. And English is just one of the worst in the world for that. And to contrast, you look at Spanish, which is, you know, our largest second language, it's a transparent relationship. The technical term is orthography, how letters and sounds are sort of connected and represented. However, I would say, you know, when I dug into the data, just to give, you know, just sort of an illustration, when we look at the 10 largest districts in the state, every single one of them had a decline in the percentage of Hispanic third graders that were at college and career ready, except one, and that was CMS. And it actually upticked by 1.6%. We had a third of our third graders who took the EOG were Hispanic. Now, they're not all English learners. I want to acknowledge that. But that's the second highest among, you know, the top 10 districts. And as you said before, we had like 47% of our third graders in Charlotte, Mecklenburg schools, were what the state calls economically disadvantaged. That's pretty high. By contrast, Union County was 35%. So it's not to take anything away from the great work that they're doing, but it does just say it's a little challenging to compare districts of different sizes and demographics. And I think when we compare CMS to the state and the other 9 largest districts, CMS sort of held its own this last year.
I only have about 2 minutes left, and we've been focusing on CMS, but last week the National Center of Education Statistics released a national report card, which we've alluded to a couple of times. Those scores, too, are abysmal. In fact, they represent historic lows, and Matthew Soldner is that organization's acting director.
I will not speculate today about the potential causes of these trends, but I will share this concern with you. These results should galvanize all of us to take concerted, focused action to accelerate student learning.
So, Dr. Kearns, you are on an advisory committee with that organization, the National Center of Education Statistics. These are the first time these specific tests have been administered since 2019, and they show a decline in student performance in both math and reading nationwide that dates to before the pandemic. The scores overall are 10 points lower than the first time those tests were administered in 1992, and Matthew Soldner says the organization has been warning about this decline repeatedly for years. With these repeated warnings, why are the scores continuing to go down? Is nobody listening? Are we not putting enough money or effort behind this? And I have 30 seconds.
That's a tremendous question. I think maybe one thing to focus on, like, what does work? Like, what shows some success? You all have, you know, heard about the Mississippi Miracle and more recently the success of the Louisiana public schools in really turning things around. And I think a couple of things that have happened there are that they have linked this initial learning about how reading works with professional learning, ongoing professional learning. And that's something we need to see more of.
So this will be an ongoing story for the rest of our lives. So stay tuned. We'll have more on that as it becomes available. Dr. Devin Kearns, good night, distinguished professor of early literacy at NC State University. Monroe Richardson, executive director of Read Charlotte. And James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.